This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine, 9 minutes past 8 o'clock on this Thursday, February the 8th. Good to have you with us. We will be talking with Mark Stein this hour. He is the author of America Alone, The End of the World as We Know It, in which he writes, "It's the end of the world. Head for the hills." No, wait, don't head for the hills. They're full of Islamist terrorist camps. Let me put it in a slightly bigger nutshell. Much of what we loosely call the Western world will not survive the 21st century, and much of it will effectively disappear within our lifetimes, including many, if not most, European countries. He says it is America alone, the only hope against what he calls the great plague that has already devastated Europe. That being the virus of Islamism. We'll talk about it. We'll welcome your thoughts and questions for him at 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. In Madison, 263-1890, 263-1890, or send an email to talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Please include your first name and your community with your email. Mark Stein writes on war, politics, the arts, and culture for major publications in the U.S. His column appears in the Chicago Sun-Times, the New York Sun, the Washington Times, and other newspapers. He is the author of America Alone, The End of the World as We Know It. Good morning.
Good morning to you, Joy.
Thanks a lot for being with us.
My pleasure.
Well, this sounds like a real doomsday scenario.
It is a doomsday scenario, unfortunately. I try to be jolly about it, but it is hard to be jolly about. We're witnessing the end, effectively, of the post-Second World War order. And it's really, I wrote the book really because I wanted to kind of put the so-called war on terror in a broader context. And that is that even if there was no war in Iraq and Afghanistan, and even if there were no bombs going off in Bali and Madrid and London, and no one was flying planes into tall buildings in New York, the Western world, the civilized world, to use a very loose term, would still be in danger of losing this thing. I mean, basically, what we regard as the traditional order of the world in the modern era is in a very weak state at the moment, and most of it, as I said in that passage you quoted just now, will not survive.
Yeah, why is it in such a weak state?
Well, basically, most of the advanced world, apart from the United States, has pretty much given up breeding. 17 European countries have what they call lowest low fertility rates, which is below 1.3 children per couple, which is a rate from which no society has ever recovered. In other words, if you're a country like Spain, where the average couple now has 1.1, 1.2 children, you're basically halving with every generation. So you're going out of business. And in sometimes, you look at countries that are going out of business, like Japan, which has deathbed demography. Japan, but as a matter of choice, has no immigration. It's basically the demographic death spiral in laboratory conditions. You can just look at the Japanese getting older and older and fading and fading. And then in other places, you have the additional factor of widespread Muslim immigration. That's what's happened in Europe. Sometimes you have traditional Muslim populations who've been there, obviously, a long time, such as in the Russian Federation. And as most of the Russians, the Slav Russians, are kind of dying off and face down in the vodka, the Muslim populations are the only ones maintaining healthy birth rates. So on some projections, the Russian army, for example, will be majority Muslim by the year 2015, which should add an interesting wrinkle to the Chechen War, for example. But so what you're witnessing in large parts of Europe is, in fact, not population decline, but the transfer of real estate from one population to another. And that is, I think, a real tectonic change for strategists in Washington.
I'm not sure I completely understand. We're talking about the birth rates going down for Christians and populations of Muslims going up, so therefore that's why it's the end of the world?
Well, I wouldn't call the average ethnic European in Europe these days Christian. I think it's more accurate to say they're post-Christian. But what's happening is that, for example, in a country like Belgium, the relatively recently arrived Muslim populations are accounting for a larger and larger chunk of the population. Now, these people, as a Dutch cabinet minister said to me, what shocked him was discovering that young Muslims in his own country were, in fact, less assimilated than their parents and grandparents who arrived in the early 70s. These are deeply alienated Muslim populations for very good reasons in many ways. The French house their Muslim communities in these awful, dehumanizing environments on the edge of their cities, which would barely pass as prison camps, I think, in most civilized countries. So these people, for quite compelling reasons, don't feel particularly Belgian or Dutch. And as a result, that poses a profound challenge, I think, to the nation state in those Western European countries. But that's why, you know, the French aren't on board for invading Iraq. It's nothing to do with, as John Kerry argued in 2004, George W. Bush being insufficiently emollient at international summits. If you were Jacques Chirac and you had huge numbers of alienated Muslim youths in your cities with 40 to 50% unemployment rates, you wouldn't be in a great hurry to send your troops marching into Arab countries alongside the great Satan. I mean, this is nothing to do with a kind of personality difference. It's to do with basic geopolitical realities and demographic realities.
Yeah. So what is the answer then for Europe, is to have more babies or what?
Well, I think some European countries are basically, they've left it too late and there are no happy endings. I mean, I think one of the tragedies, when you look at a country like the Netherlands, it now has net emigration. That's to say, Dutch people have concluded their country is lost and they're emigrating to Canada, Australia, or New Zealand, or anywhere that will have them. Amsterdam, which was always held up as a beacon of the most tolerant city in Europe, and in the Western world, indeed, you talk to American gay men in middle age, and in the late 60s and early 70s, when they found living in, not to pick on Wisconsin, but they, mm-hmm. when they found living in your state, for example, a bit uncomfortable, they took off to Amsterdam and marveled at a city where you could just stroll around arm in arm with your boyfriend, you could be openly gay, you could go to gay bars, you could have an openly gay lifestyle, and it would be absolutely marvelous. Well, they don't have that. That is under danger now, under threat now. You have situations where they're having gay bashings in Amsterdam, because all those gay guys who moved from America to the Netherlands because they found Jerry Falwell and Pat Robertson a bit intolerant have found that, you know, in Amsterdam now there's a serious problem with really serious major theocrats who make Jerry Falwell and Pat Robertson look like a bit of easy listening mood music. So I think that is the difference, that there's a contradiction. I think I say in the book at some point, you know, that if we talk about Iraq being fundamentally incompatible because it's got Kurds and Sunni and Shia, how plausible is it to have a country like the Netherlands, where you basically got an increasingly Islamifying country with this sort of gay hedonist pothead utopia in a couple of its urban centers? That's a lot more incoherent than the present demographic structure of Iraq.
Yeah. And so tell us why you say America alone can fight this, or America alone will survive this.
Well, I think I use America alone in a couple of senses. That's to say that it risks being literally alone in a very lonely planet if you take the situation that its traditional allies are not going to be there for the United States in any meaningful sense, really from now on. I mean, what one can argue about the merits of the Iraq War or the Afghan War, but the Afghan War, for example, most of our European allies are nominally in favor of. That's the good war. They don't actually make any useful contribution to that. The Norwegians, for example, are on board in Afghanistan, but the deal was that they can't fight any combat in a combat role because they're not equipped for that. And in fact, then when they got out there and were just manning the photocopier back at the barracks or whatever they were doing, they decided that that was a bit too hot for them, and they asked to be transferred to a province in which no fighting was taking place. So they're standing shoulder to shoulder with us, as long as there's a couple of provinces between the shoulders. You're going to get far more decisions like that. I mean, this NATO is basically now a postmodern alliance. It's an alliance of militaries that don't have any meaningful militaries and have compelling geopolitical reasons for not sending them into action alongside the United States. So America has to find new allies. And if you look at nations like India and Singapore and some of the rising powers of the 21st century, they're countries that often share the same view of issues like the Islamist threat as the Americans. But they doubt that Washington has the will to really see this thing through. And the danger of that, then, is that they will decide to reach their own accommodations. And at that point, you reach a kind of tipping point where the American moment is essentially over and America has no credibility in the world.
Yeah, let me take a short break and welcome callers to talk with Mark Stein, author of America Alone, The End of the World as We Know It. 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. In Madison, 263-1890, 263-1890. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine, 22 minutes past 8 o'clock on this Thursday, February the 8th. Coming up after 5 o'clock, it's At Issue with Peter Donalds in for Ben Marins today. He'll be talking with the author of Race Manners for the 21st Century, Navigating the Minefield Between Black and White Americans in an Age of Fear. That's At Issue, coming up after 5 this afternoon. We're talking with Mark Stein. He is author of America Alone, The End of the World as We Know It. He says in the book that America must get serious about fighting its enemies, Islamist terrorists, or risk its very existence. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. Mark Stein, why do you say America isn't serious about fighting its enemies?
Well, because I think this is a different kind of war. You know, if you were to pick a fight with America on a battlefield and have a tank battle, you'd lose. If you were to have a naval battle with the United States Navy, you'd lose. If you were to get into an air war with the United States, you'd lose. The Islamists have figured out, obviously, that that is therefore not the battlefield on which to hold the struggle. And they've concluded that if this is a long war, then what matters is essentially ideology and will. And they figure that they have that, and that essentially the Western world and the leader of the Western world, the United States, doesn't. And I think that is a largely valid critique they make, that in a sense, you see a lot of, for example, this plot they bust up in Britain last week, where some guys were planning to kidnap a British soldier and behead him live on video. You know, the FBI and Scotland Yard and MI5 and the Mounties up in Canada have been very good at busting up individual plots. And it may well be that they continue to get lucky for that, time in, time out, day in, day out, for years and years and years. But at one point, they won't get lucky. The fact of the matter is that if in an ideological struggle, you have to have some strategy for taking on the ideology. Essentially, Saudi Arabia and Iran, the two wealthiest nations in the Middle East, have spent huge amounts of money radicalizing Muslim populations around the world. Not just in Pakistan and Indonesia, but also in traditionally moderate areas such as Central Asia and the Balkans and Western Europe and Canada and the United States, too. And they don't have to radicalize an awful lot of them for it to become a significant problem. And so unless you've got a strategy for rolling back the Saudi-funded subversion of the entire planet, you're not really dealing with it. That's why things like, you know, the surge in Baghdad, if it works, fine. If it doesn't work, that'll be a whole other thing. But that's really not what this whole thing is about. The real fight is taking place on a much more elusive battlefield that doesn't often swim into view.
So the debate over wanting to get out or stay in Iraq is not what you're referring to when you say we may not have the will to fight this war?
Well, I think it does demonstrate the lack of will. I think if you're the typical prime minister sitting, say, in South Asia somewhere, and you're watching CNN International all week long, and it's a constant preoccupation of Washington politicians. They're talking about exit strategies. They're talking about how to get out. They're talking essentially about a face-saving way of withdrawing from Iraq. And I think it is right to conclude that that is about American will. But that's the point. But that's the point. You know, Iraq is about Iraq. If you happen to be living in Tikrit or Fallujah, if you're living anywhere else on the planet, Iraq is about America. So the significance of what happens in Iraq is what significance it has for the rest of the world's view of America. And if America is seen to lose in Iraq, then there's no reason why anyone should take it seriously again, not just Russia and China and Iran and North Korea, but there's no reason for Sweden or New Zealand to take America seriously again. In that sense, Vietnam would have become a pattern, and it would have demonstrated that essentially Osama bin Laden's critique is right, that this is a puffed-up, pampered superpower, like one of the late-period Ottoman sultans. He's sort of curled up on his cushions, and he wants to watch American Idol and Dancing with the Stars, and if you give him just a pinprick in his toe, he'll curl up howling in pain, and he's got no stomach for the big fight. Well, that is not a way to stay a great power for long, and no power that becomes perceived as that does stay a great power.
Do you think these mainly Democratic-sponsored resolutions condemning the surge in Iraq or calling for some sort of withdrawal are playing into the hands of the terrorists, that this is strengthening the terrorists?
Well, let's be bipartisan here, Joy. I think some of these Republican ones are doing the same thing, too. I think my own senator in New Hampshire, Senator Sununu, who is a Republican, and by the standards of New England Republicans, was regarded as a rather steel-spined one. He was stopped on the stairs in the Senate and by some pursuing pressmen and asked what his view of the war was, what his position on Iraq was, and he said, "I'm still looking." In other words, as if he hadn't got the briefings from the focus groups back yet. I don't think. You know, one can make arguments about whether one should have got into Iraq, but I think once you're in it, you should win it, because the cost of losing wars is extremely dangerous for nations, and especially America, I would say, which psychologically doesn't seem to lose wars or peripheral wars, as it were, in quite the same way that the previous great powers did. You know, so if the idea, if you look at how psychologically traumatizing Vietnam was, for example, I think a clear perception of defeat in Iraq would be just as traumatizing, and it would seem to me that no credible assertive American foreign policy would emerge from that for decades.
We'll take some calls, and we do have an open line for you if you'd like to talk with Mark Stein, author of America Alone, The End of the World as We Know It. Roman in Mequon is first. Hi, Roman.
Hi. I have a question. Isn't it going to happen to America? Because a lot of cities overwhelmed by Muslims. If you look like Detroit, Cleveland, and a lot of cities on the East Coast, the same going on as in Europe. Isn't it going to happen to United States pretty soon as well?
Well, I do think there's a difference between American Muslims and European Muslims, and indeed Canadian Muslims, in that I think America, whatever one feels about immigration and assimilation, I think the United States still does a better job of assimilating immigrants and giving them access to the opportunities of America than Europe does. I mean, the big difference here is when you look at the number of people who have been picked up with, for example, British passports in Afghanistan and in Pakistan and some of these other places. I mean, this is something that there is really no equivalent in numbers terms for in the United States, even Canadians. I mean, astonishing, whole families of Canadians have been captured in connection with terrorism and the war on terror. Indeed, one way of looking at the so-called war on terror is that it's not goat herds in Afghanistan and Pakistan who are threatening the United States. The cell that pulled off September 11th was essentially a German cell. If you look at the so-called 20th hijacker who was on trial here, he was someone who came up, he was raised in France, and came up through the European welfare system. The shoe bomber was British. The guys who blew up the London Tube were British subjects. So in a sense, the difference is between how America treats its Muslims and how Europe treats its Muslims can be easily seen by just looking at the number of convicted terrorists who passed through the European welfare system. There is a big difference, I think, between American Muslim populations and the European and Canadian ones.
Thank you, Roman, for the call. Chris in Port Wing is with us next. Hello, Chris.
Good morning. Thanks for having the show.
Yes, go ahead, Chris.
Well, I'm interested in how the guest seems to think that a continuing struggle of a violent nature can lead to some positive solution, because in our current situation, we are confronting violence with violence, and as Martin Luther King Jr. said years ago, we will not break out the darkness with darkness. We need light. And the only real resolutions for the long term we're going to see for any of these conflicts in the world is nonviolent conflict resolution that's binding on all sides and that takes all sides into consideration. I find it very offensive that the guest can use terminology that is so hierarchical and one-sided that we start talking about us and them and how one great nation takes care of its Islamic population compared to another, because, by the way, people are individual, independent people. And the rise of the awareness in our culture in the United States of the existence of Islam may be new, but let's remember that Islam is a very old element to our world civilization and is easily, comparatively, at least as civilized or more civilized than Christian nations, depending on how you interpret the term civilization. So I hope that the discussion can move towards an understanding that violence on either side is a degradation of the human population, and what we need to do is be very creative and bring a new level of diplomacy into this wonderful potential computer age of discussion.
Yeah, what do you think of that, Mark Stein?
Well, I think that's all fine and dandy, and if he wants to fly off and talk about that in the tribal lands of Pakistan, I'd be interested to see if he came back alive. The fact of the matter is that Martin Luther King Jr., yes, he did talk in that way. He was dealing with white Americans. He was dealing with white racist Americans. He was dealing with white racist Americans who wanted to exclude blacks from a particular sections of the school bus and particular drinking fountains and particular restaurants and all the rest of it. And that is a very different opponent to be going up against. And one can afford to say things like that in the way that people often quote Gandhi. Gandhi had the great advantage of being in rebellion against the British. A lot of the time, you're not up against an enemy who is prepared to be that decent about the differences he has with you. You're up against an enemy like, for example, the guys in Beslan, Russia, who looked into the eyes of those schoolchildren they kidnapped and then killed them. You're in the eyes of people like the couple who wandered into the wedding in Amman, Jordan, and they looked at their fellow Muslims celebrating that wedding, and then they pulled the suicide bomber belt and blew them all supposedly to paradise or wherever else they wound up. So often you don't have the advantage of dealing with as benign an enemy as some redneck American southerner of the 1950s or a British colonial administrator of the 1940s.
Yeah, so
sometimes you're up against more primal forces.
Chris seems to want a nonviolent or a political solution. There is no political solution.
Oh no, absolutely. I'm comfortable with the use of violence by which he means military force. If you wish to define it as violence, I'm comfortable with the use of violence, as he puts it, as a component of national defense. But he's right in the sense that there is only a kind of political situation to this. This is the point I was making earlier when I said that America has fabulous tanks and planes and naval carriers, but that it is not primarily about that. And in fact, the danger is that if I agree with him, I don't want a lot of fighting and I don't want a lot of deaths and I don't want a lot of bombs. But the longer that that America and its allies leave it before attending seriously to this ideological subversion, the more violence there's going to be and the more people will die, because it will be exactly the same thing as in the 1930s, where the points at which you could have settled issues reasonably peacefully will pass, and in the end you'll have one big almighty planetary conflagration in which millions will die. So if you don't want millions to die, you're much better off trying to figure out strategies to deal with it right now before that becomes before the situation breaks down and that becomes inevitable.
Yeah, talk a little bit more, Mark Stein. I think many might be uncomfortable with words like that, that the great plague, the virus of Islamism. Are you painting all Muslims with the same violent brush?
No, not at all. Not at all. I think Islam, one has to respect Islam in part because it's the fastest growing religion in North America and Europe, not just through immigration, but through conversion. I mean, clearly there are a lot of people who are drawn to it. But there is an issue, which I did touch on earlier, which is that clearly, something has gone wrong among Muslim populations living in the West. That's to say that if you look at, for example, a cell that was broken up in Toronto a few months ago, they were arrested for plotting to behead the Canadian Prime Minister. The girl is who I think is was about 18, 19, and is married to one of the plotters. Her father is the pharmacist at the Princess Patricia's Canadian Light Infantry military base in Alberta. He's a conventional assimilated immigrant. He's a Muslim who came over 20 years ago. He regards himself as Canadian. He's proudly supporting, as a pharmacist, the military men at the Princess Patricia's base. His daughter is a much more radical Muslim. She named her child after a Chechen freedom fighter, as she saw it, who was killed by the Russians. She insisted her husband sign a prenup committing to jihad, which is a pretty serious prenup, I think, certainly for most guys' point of view. And she is, in other words, she has a completely more intense, fierce, and in a sense, as Christians would say, fundamentalist view of Islam than her father and her grandparents do. And that is a phenomenon of our time, and it's a phenomenon largely fueled by people that we pass off as allies, such as the Saudi Arabians. It's been funded by Saudi money, which means it's funded every time somebody in Wisconsin stops at a gas station and fills up their car.
Chris in Milwaukee sent us an email, and he says, I find it interesting that your guest cites Saudi Arabia as a source of financial support for Islamic extremists. I would like to point out that the United States of America has fostered a close financial and economic relationships with the Saudi monarchy. The U.S. has also in the past sold weapons to Iran and offered training and support to Afghan rebels against the Soviet Union. It seems to me that the United States' propensity to manipulate others to further our own economic interests is what's really perpetuating this Islamic movement.
Well, I'm not going to particularly disagree with that. I think creating Saudi Arabia was a total mistake, and perhaps the most catastrophic mistake made by the United States in the 20th century. I think it has been a disaster, and the idea of putting all the eggs in the House of Saud's basket case of a royal family I think has been is disgraceful and is immensely harmful to U.S. interests. And I think it's disgusting that 5 years after September 11th, Saudi money is still buying up think tanks and schools and funding prison programs and putting ex-ambassadors on the payroll. It should be a condition of government service in this country that if you serve as a United States ambassador, you can't serve on any body funded by Saudi money. But the fact of the matter is that they're hollowing out the U.S. establishment from within, and it is disgraceful. As to the Afghan thing, I would agree with you. You know what? I would agree with your emailer that what happened in the 1970s is that in the wake of Vietnam, a weak and tentative America decided that it could not openly resist Soviet aggression in Afghanistan, so outsourced it to the Saudi, to Prince Turki, one of the more sinister members of the Saudi royal family, and the ISI, the Pakistani Intelligence Services, which is another malign creation. And it allowed them, in effect, to run the Afghan resistance on behalf of the United States. Well, they also had their own interests, and they turned what America thought of as a conventional nationalist struggle into a jihad. The lesson of that is that what's contemptible is trying to think you can have an outsourced foreign policy dependent on thugs and dictators. A successful foreign policy, you promote American values, and those values should be liberty and free markets and individual rights and freedom of religion and freedom of expression, not by finding which nickel and dime thug is prepared to sign on to the CIA's payroll every month. That is a short-term and disastrous way of doing things.
We are talking with Mark Stein. He is author of America Alone, The End of the World as We Know It, in which he paints a pretty dark future in which all of the European nations, old Europe, falls to Islamic fundamentalism, and the United States remains the last Western democracy if it begins to get serious about fighting its enemies. 1-800-642-1234 and Madison 263-1890. Mark Stein is a writer. He writes on war, politics, the arts and cultures. His column appears in the Chicago Sun-Times, the New York Sun, the Washington Times, and other newspapers. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. About 17 minutes before 9 o'clock, coming up after 9, Kathleen Dunn is with you. Kathleen and her guest will talk about the debate over the Iraq war resolutions. Senate has stalled or delayed action on the Iraq war resolutions, but House Democrats are vowing to debate and pass a similar measure. So more talk about that coming up after 9 o'clock. Our next caller for Mark Stein, author of America Alone, The End of the World as We Know It, is Laura in Madison. Hello, Laura.
Hi. So taking a more immediate look at things, what does victory look like in Iraq, and how do we know when we've achieved it? I don't think the president's really told us that.
Yes, I agree with you, really, on that there was not a clearly identifiable measure by which we would understand whether we've won in Iraq. So as a result, a lot of people think we've lost. Well, of course, if we've lost, who has won? I think it is hard to say who has, that any particular faction has won in Iraq. I would regard, if we just go back to 2003, I mean, I don't want to go over the whole thing again, but I would say the immediate victory was the removal of Saddam Hussein, who was a hangover from the September the 10th world that could not continue in office. So he's gone. The question then is whether you can create an Iraq that is better than it was before, which isn't difficult, but is also better than most of the other available options in the in that part of the world. And I would say that is the real measure of victory. In other words, can you wind up with some imperfect but relatively stable state that is nevertheless shows other neighboring countries that there is a better way than some of the dead ends they've got mired in? And I believe that's still possible in Iraq. I certainly think that terrible mistakes have been made, and terrible mistakes are continuing to be made. But the fact of the matter is that the Kurdish North is one of the most agreeable parts of the Middle East to be in. It's got a tourist boom, hard to get a hotel there. They're building new hotels all over the place. The south, I think the British let Basra slip out of control, and that has become problematic now. But generally, you know, as a general point, I think Iraq will be okay from an Iraqi point of view. The question is whether Americans succeed in snatching defeat from the jaws of victory over there.
Thank you, Laura. Maddie in Wapaka, hello.
Hi. I agree with your guests on almost everything excepting Iraq. I think you're kind of contradicting yourself when you say that we have to fight this in a new way. I feel that, and then you say, but we have to win in Iraq. I feel that the way that we have to fight this is by being defensive, such as the way that we are when people travel on the airlines, by stopping people from even getting on a plane with weapons of any kind. And so I... Like I say, I just kind of feel like you're contradicting yourself.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Defense, not offense, Mark Stein?
No, I really don't agree with that. I think that is almost a certain way to lose, because, in fact, it plays to the Islamist strength, which is that they're very good at just kind of muddling along just below the radar and effecting huge change without people even becoming aware of it. I think I say in the book at one point that that's the real difference between the United States and Europe on this thing. For the United States, this has been more or less a conventional war. You go to faraway places and you kill foreigners. In the United Kingdom and in continental Europe, it's a civil war. Those are British subjects born and bred who blew up the London Tube and killed their fellow British subjects. Those are citizens of the French Republic who were rioting and burning cars and torching police stations every night in the streets of French cities a year ago. So that's the difference. If you try to fight it defensive, that means not just losing most of the Western world because they can't fight it at the borders because the problem is inside the borders, but simply put, in a globalized world, you cannot be an isolationist 19th century republic. You can't simply say we're going to pull up the drawbridge and hold the world at bay. This is a country that can't even hold two relatively benign neighbors at bay on its northern and southern borders. The chances of being able to hold the entire planet at bay is simply preposterous and is not going to work.
Thank you to Maddie. We'll go now to Kay in Maguanago. Hello, Kay.
Yes. I'm calling to agree with the caller that was on a couple calls ago about not solving this in a violent way. I think that when we talk about other people, we should not be talking about them in a way that will further the fear that people are already feeling. I think that the premise that we went to war was built on fear. A lot of this is built on fear. He talked about the difference between dealing with people from the South, when he talked about Martin Luther King, and looking into the eyes of people who are rednecks versus looking into the eyes of people who are terrorists. I just think that we are all in this together. I don't care if you're Jewish, Christian, Muslim, Buddhist, and all those children who are dying over there, all those people who are dying, all our people who are dying, are all human beings. And until we look at this in a much more minuscule way, and if I look into the eyes of my neighbor who is Muslim or whoever, and I'm not afraid of them, this is going to continue. We cannot keep killing people and expect to solve our problems. He talked about the...
Yeah, hold on, Kay. I'll give you a follow-up, Mark Stein.
Well, I'm sympathetic to that in theory. I've seen those people driving around with that coexist bumper sticker where the zero is the peace sign and then one of the other letters is the Christian cross and one of the other letters, I think the C is the Muslim crescent and the Star of David's in there and all the rest of it. And it's a very fine idea, but the trouble is that multiculturalism, the idea that we're all the same, in a sense becomes a cult of ignorance because it absolves us from having to understand the very specific situations of people around the planet. The fact of the matter is that Muslims do not feel, even moderate Muslims do not feel we're all the same. They feel there are Muslims, and then they feel there are other people, and that there are significant differences between them. And there was an imam speaking at Trinity College, Dublin, a couple of weeks ago, and someone asked him what the Prophet Muhammad's message was to non-believers. And he said the Prophet's message to infidels is, "I am here to slaughter you all." That isn't a multicultural notion. The idea that Jews and Christians and Muslims and Buddhists and all the rest are all equal. If you look at the difficulties in the world today, most of them take place on the boundary between the Muslim world and the rest of the world. So, for example, in Nigeria, it's Muslims against Nigerian Christians. In the Palestinian territories, you've got Muslims and Jews. In Chechnya, you've got Muslims and Russians. In Kashmir, you've got Muslims and Hindus. In southern Thailand, you've got Muslims going up against Buddhists. In Bali, you've got Muslims going up against Australian hippy-dippy backpackers and nightclubbers. What all these things have in common is that Islam finds it very difficult to embrace the notion that your guest is peddling, that we can all just sort of rub along, Jew, Christian, Muslim, Buddhist, stoner, backpacker, all getting along fine in one great multicultural utopia. When she builds it, I'll buy a condo there, but it doesn't exist.
Well, I know it doesn't exist, and I don't think the answer to it is to just say it doesn't exist and to go on and to continue to be fearful of each other. I belong to a certain religious thing, and I was taught that mine was better than somebody else's. You know, I don't believe that anymore. And I think people who are Islam, there's many people who do not believe that they're different than we are. There's a certain segment of each religion and each culture that is that way. And I don't think that those of us who wear bumper stickers on our car and so on and so forth are ignorant or naive. Nonviolence is not something which is passive.
Yeah. Kay, will you just address, though, our guest saying that the radical Islam wants to slaughter us, and so you're saying that's okay, we can get along?
No, I'm not saying it's okay at all, Joy. Mm. I'm saying that we have a lot of work to do then, so that eventually, a long way down the road, they won't want to slaughter us anymore, nor will we want to slaughter them. There's been all kinds of historical cases of Christians killing people, too. Mm-hmm. So, that's my premise of my thing. I just don't believe in that this violence and continuing it is going to come to any good end in the long run. You know, might be a reflexive short victory, but...
Well, let's put it in extreme circumstances, then. What would you do if you were in the situation that you find that a lot of people around the world have found themselves in, that those school children in Beslan found themselves in? What would you do if you happened to be on a plane sitting next to the shoe bomber? That was a plane flying from France to the United States, and it wasn't just the big bullying Yankee cowboys who jumped up and held down the shoe bomber before he could light his shoe and blow up the plane. It was also the sophisticated continental Frenchman who also joined in that. But at some point, people have to have a survival instinct, because if your reaction when faced with someone who wants to kill you is that, well, he may kill me now, but maybe a century or two down the line he'll learn that that's not the way. There's going to be an awful lot of dead people around the planet before that thing's played out. And the planet, when the last man standing, blood-soaked from having won his victory against all the people who believe nonviolence is the answer, is not going to be a very agreeable place to be on.
Okay, thank you for the call. I'm going to go now to Buck in Madison. Hello, Buck.
Hello. Nice discussion, and I'll get your book. In fact, everybody else listening is ahead of me at the public radio reserving it. So,
Okay, go
success.
Ahead, Buck.
About population, are you proposing that Holland should breed faster? Do we need more children?
Well, I do think, and again, this comes back to what previous callers were saying, that if you do happen to think that you've created a benign, more civilized, more tolerant state, there's not much point in doing it for just one generation. You know, the Europeans and a lot of people in this country think they've got the right answer. They've got socialized health care. They've got cradle-to-grave welfare. They've got long weeks of paid vacation. And they've created a kind of perfect modern social democratic state. What's the point if it just lasts for one generation? If, say, Scandinavians and Dutch and Canadians are so necessary for spreading the message of peace in the world, you've got to have a certain number of Canadians and Dutch and Scandinavians around to do it. Otherwise, they'll have no influence. And the people who are around in huge numbers will have the influence. So I do believe that all advanced societies now, not just Western nations, Russia and Japan and too should be, and Europe and Canada and the United States should have seriously natalist policies that encourage people to have vigorous families that can sustain the population and, in particular, sustain the social programs that all these countries introduced in the 1950s on traditional birth rates and which are now basically becoming unaffordable. If you think Social Security is a looming crisis in America, you should look at the public pensions liabilities in Greece, where it's going to be 28% of GDP in a couple of decades. Well, that's total societal collapse unless the Greeks get busy having traditional Mediterranean families again.
Thank you, Buck. Dave in Menominee. Hello, you're on the air.
Hi, good morning. Our Constitution is bigger than these threats, and the Constitution is more important than the 3,000 people that died in New York. And the way that you talk is really a threat to our Constitution. Of course, we can be in danger, but our Constitution is more important than...
Yeah.
The way that you want to take, you know, the way you talk, our rights are going to be taken away systematically.
I haven't suggested taking any away of your rights, have I? I mean, it's hardly my business as a foreigner to interpret the United States Constitution, but what constitutional right am I taking away from you?
Well, you know, I think the way that the fear-mongering that you're bringing into us is trying to break down the way that we feel about our precious Constitution.
No, absolutely not. In fact, if you're saying to me that I'm one of these people who's in favor of big government solutions that will effectively restrict people's movement, restrict the books they can read at the library, absolutely not. I'm the opposite of that. I want people to read more widely at the library, and I don't want to be disturbed by every time I go to the bank and I want to wire some money. I don't want to be told that I've got to fill in a lot of paperwork and show my passport and social security number and all the rest of it because of the Patriot Act. I'm absolutely not in favor of big government solutions or restrictions on liberty. I'm in favor, actually, of free-born citizens exercising natural human curiosity to take the trouble to read about the state of the world today. This is not something that can be solved by the kind of big government statist approach, which is what they're trying in Europe.
And we'll have to leave it there. We're out of time. Mark Stein, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Joy. It was a rollicking roller coaster for me.
Well, your book is a rollicking roller coaster, too. Mark Stein, author of America Alone, The End of the World as We Know It. Thanks to Carmen Jackson for producing the hour. Thanks to Cale Plowman for on-air production. Thank you for listening and for calling in. Stay tuned. There's much more to come. I'm Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.